the United States is on a true front battle, one on the fight against COVID-19 and the other one with China, which will have serious ramifications for years to come. We caught up with Robert Daly, director of the Institute on China and the United States at the Woodrow Wilson Center based in Washington, D.C., to give on-the-ground perspective of COVID-19 and implications for U.S.-China relations. Hello, Robert. Thanks for joining us. What a turbulent time we all live in. Almost no country is immune to this novel coronavirus. China's ambassador to the U.S., Cui Tianke, recently wrote an op-ed in the New York Times in which he calls for the U.S. and China to cooperate and fight against COVID-19. Unfortunately, the world's two biggest economic giants are engaged in multidimensional war that includes trade war, diplomatic war, conspiracy theory war, etc. How can both countries overcome mutual distrust and urgently work together to fight this global war on infectious diseases?
So you're asking the right question. And so far, I'm afraid that the answer is largely that they can't really come together. It's true that both countries are in various ways calling for cooperation. The real question is, can America cooperate with China if Americans think that China is using the coronavirus opportunistically to spread its own global influence at America's expense, to spread the illiberal practices of the CCP? Can we cooperate fully when we also are concerned about what's going on in Hong Kong, what's going on in the South China Sea and the Taiwan Straits, when we're concerned about Xinjiang, and overall are concerned that China wants to spread sort of its authoritarianism or techno-totalitarianism outside of its borders? That's the question for Americans. The question for Chinese is, can they really cooperate with us when we are objecting to so many Chinese behaviors, trying to staunch the spread of Huawei 5G systems, when we are passing laws criticizing China for its governance of Hong Kong, for its attitudes toward Taiwan, Xinjiang, etc. So on both sides, saying that we should cooperate is very easy. But do we mean, when we say this to the other side, everything will be well if you will cooperate on our terms? We haven't really faced the difficult questions about cooperation. Cooperation can still happen, but it's happening between corporations, between localities and communities, states and localities, between civic groups. So there is cooperation moving back and forth. The last thing I would say about cooperation, and I hope that it will happen. I was one of the signatories on the American letter for 100 people. We signed a letter calling for cooperation, and we meant it. But in the early phases of the coronavirus in Wuhan, when America wanted to send experts to China with from the CDC to Wuhan, as it had done in the past, China wasn't very interested in cooperating then. Now China is calling for cooperation. This is perhaps an American point of view, under circumstances in which cooperation would not cast aspersions on the ability of the Communist Party to govern their own country, but when cooperation would help present the Communist Party as a provider of global public goods. So it didn't call for cooperation until that met China's goals for building its comprehensive national power. So there's so much distrust. We don't know yet how to rise above it.
There is a deeply mistrust between, for example, in the United States, between Democrats and Republicans. But in a such challenging time, they were able to come together and pass the third relief package, which was worth $2.2 trillion. It was passed in the Senate 96-0. So if they take that spirit and then apply to U.S.-China relations, they should set aside their differences or manage their differences for the time being and work together. Because we see in the news every day, we lose people around the world, especially in America, which is now the epicenter of the outbreak.
That's right. And I think I agree with you. And again, this is why a lot of Americans and people over the world are calling for cooperation. But You know, when the Democrats and the Republicans came together to pass that package, it was very strongly in both of their political interests, right? Had they opposed that, it would have harmed them politically. And even though they passed that package, really vicious infighting continues. And the divisions in America, politically, socially, culturally, are as strong as ever and perhaps getting stronger during the coronavirus. We just saw, for example, President Trump firing the watchdog, the inspector general, who was to have overseen the executive branch's disbursement of a lot of support to corporations to make sure that it was done in an equitable way. That person was just fired. And so the real toxins, you know, the bile that each party has for each other, that hasn't gone away. And when you look at, if you analogize, as you just suggested, from the Republican and Democratic Party to the U.S. to China, then there's a question. This particularly has to do with Chinese political culture. We've got other problems on American society. I don't mean to suggest this is the fault of one side. There's plenty of fault to go around. But it's not part of Chinese political culture to cooperate or work with an entity or another country while they are also objecting to your behavior, or from the CCP's point of view, attacking you on other fronts. China is comfortable cooperating when it's cooperative across the board, right? When you're a hao peng you. They don't want to cooperate when you are saying that they are violating human rights in Xinjiang, or when they say that you are expansionist in the South China Sea. I think that Americans, for many problems that we have, the problems with governance that we continue to demonstrate, we're a little bit better at operating on various tracks at the same time. This is not something that the CCP is very good at. We have had influential people within the CCP saying, oh, you know, you want to take masks from us, you need ventilators, respirators, maybe it's time for you to give us a break on these other issue areas. So there's a problem. You know, the U.S. has problems cooperating, to be sure. The CCP, it's really not in their DNA. Xi Jinping likes to talk about the DNA of the Communist Party. It's not in their DNA to simply and purely cooperate in certain aspects of your relationship while you're going at each other, you know, hammer and tongs in other aspects. So this is going to be a difficult process. Can we find ways when our distrust is so deep, when our interests really do clash in so many ways, when we are competing all around the world, as you said, in a comprehensive way, to increase our influence, including at the other's expense? Can we find a way to cooperate? It's going to take a long time to work this out.
Well, it's not time to find innovative ways to cooperate in a new era.
Well, and maybe, you know, maybe places like Hong Kong can play a role in this. There are lots of intermediaries. And some civil society organizations, universities, hospitals, states, localities, and they are doing it. And that's what's really encouraging, is that in the midst of all of this, there's still a tremendous amount of interest, a tremendous amount of fellow feeling at the community, personal, and institutional level. And I think that that can be leveraged, but that cannot hide, that cannot be used to wish away the growing geostrategic distrust.
When China was the epicenter of the outbreak, the country mishandled the situation on the outset, but its draconian measures to impose lockdown had effectively flattened the curve fairly quickly. As the virus now spreads across the globe, the tide has turned. China is seen as a global leader to combat COVID-19, giving medical equipment and sending medical staff to support other countries. What are the implications of China's soft power, as well as its model of governance?
So this is a key question. I think it's a little bit too soon to say. We don't know where the coronavirus goes yet. We also don't know what the real situation in China is. It does seem that they've flattened the curve. It seems that transmissions are slowing. But then when you see these pictures of people packed into the trails at Huangshan and Yellow Mountain, for example, it's very hard to say where this goes. We don't know whether it will come back in the next season, you know, when it gets cold again in the fall. Many coronaviruses continue to mutate in the off-season and they come back more strongly again. So this is going to be a long story. It's not a short story. We don't yet know really how the with substandard equipment coming out. China has been dabbling also in conspiracy theories. There is no wishing away the fact that China's initial instinctive characteristic, paranoid cover-up of the situation in Wuhan, was extremely costly for China and costly for the world. Now, I don't want to overstate this, but right now in America, we have people who are saying that, you know, China must pay reparations, that there will be, you know, afterward, that China should pay for every life, that this is entirely China's fault. Clearly, that is an overstatement. Clearly, that is not true. It is true that this is both a human situation and a situation that was made worse by the Chinese Communist Party. But in America, it's also been made worse by aspects of our governance. This is undeniable. This is a matter of public record. So when we criticize China, as we should, there's a problem with that criticism, in that a lot of it implies that had China been wholly transparent, America, of course, would have been wholly wise and wholly strategic in its response. And we know that to not be true. So there's plenty of blame to go around. I'm not sure yet how this translates into more power or influence for China. If people need masks, they're glad to buy them from China. Does that mean that these countries want to be more authoritarian, or that they are going to be more acceptable of authoritarianism and of Chinese expansionism? I don't see any evidence of that. In fact, you see a blowback in Europe, even in Eastern Europe, even among the 17+1, because every time China gets emboldened or more confident and makes a move, even if it's a move supplying global public goods, as we see now, China's self-interest and desire for that power and influence is so naked and so obvious and so off-putting to so many that China tends to shoot itself in the foot even as it takes a real step forward every single time. So I think this plays out over a longer arc. It's too soon to say that this is helpful or harmful to China in its quest for soft power. And when we look at China's soft power, it's not just about, oh, they bought us masks. We still look at things like what's happening in Xinjiang and Hong Kong. It does matter. We do look at the growth of the surveillance state. We do know that Liu Xiaobo died in prison. We know that part of the story of China's handling of the coronavirus is what happened to Chen Qiushi, the blogger who was disappeared in Wuhan. It's what happened to Ren Zhijian, and to a number of others. So they've been silencing journalists and scholars. This is also part of the legacy. So yeah, I want the rest of the news, but I don't want the attacks on freedom of speech. I don't want to see something influence in the country. If I'm Ireland or Italy or Malaysia or any number of countries on China's periphery. So there's an overly simplistic narrative right now that China handled this brilliantly in the latter half, and now they're saving the world, and therefore they're going to be the new global leader. This is a simplistic narrative that China would like to have adapted. I don't think that's the way this is going to unfold.
But in terms of model governance, China effectively was able to lock down the city of Wuhan and later the whole of Hubei province and other regions, and they were able to quickly flatten the curve. But certainly you cannot do that in the United States because you have state rights. Trump first wanted to impose lockdown on New York and New Jersey, but soon faced backlash. So in the end, he just issued a statement urging citizens in those states to stay home.
Right. But two things about that. Taiwan and South Korea flattened the curve far better than China did without the same draconian measures. It's not clear that while China did flatten the curve, it's not clear that they had to go as far as they did to flatten it. This remains highly debated. And we also don't, again, we don't know what the real numbers are yet. So there are other ways to flatten the curve. And this is not to say that there aren't problems in the United States. There certainly are, but that's not what we're talking about right now. Also, I think, you know, people are smart. And it's true that in times of real crisis like this, people want to have more belief in government, and when people feel threatened or unsafe, they are willing to grant more power to government. That's true. We saw this after 9/11 in the United States. That doesn't mean we want authoritarianism all the time. See, when the coronavirus is gone, you've still got the Chinese Communist Party as a growing, you know, techno-totalitarian police state. And I don't think that most of the countries in the world want that all the time, 365, you know, 24/7. And that's a very obvious question. You say, oh, well, you know, would it have been good if the government had acted more quickly and with less resistance to close things down? Maybe, maybe. But it's not clear, you know, the huge problems with Trump's response. Is it clear that a democratic country, if we had leadership that respected science, couldn't have flattened the curve better? No, maybe we could have. So we don't know that. So I don't think you're going to see a rush for, yes, give us some of that good old Chinese authoritarianism. All of the time, we want to live under the yoke of the CCP so that the next time a virus appears, we can flatten the curve. No, nobody's calling for that. So again, we need to look out for these very simplistic narratives. And we also need to be careful about what's called the tyranny of the now. We're very caught up in the present moment. Oh, the world has changed. There's a new normal. Nothing will ever be the same again. Actually, a lot of things are going to be the same again. The people are very strongly inclined to return to the status quo ante. There are strong pressures to return to established patterns. We will find when this slows down that some of the established patterns may not be options for us or may not seem as wise, but many of them will be. So we're caught up now in these 24/7 endless headlines about the coronavirus. Most of these articles aren't worth reading. They aren't really newsworthy because people have a herd mentality. People are very afraid and there's uncertainty. And so it seems like the whole world has changed and turned upside down. It hasn't. It hasn't. There's going to be strong pressure to return to normal. Some things are going to be different, to be sure. I'm not sure that we have the wisdom to foresee those things. But there will be a return to a sort of normal, at which point the desire for normalcy, including the desire for freedom and not to live under an authoritarian nation, that's also going to reassert itself.
But I think, at least in the short to medium term, we aren't going to see any chances to go back to normalcy because we still have to practice social distancing until we have the vaccine available for COVID-19, because we don't know yet when we're going to have a re-emergence of the virus. So we just have to be really careful.
And we will be careful, and we should be careful. But does that change everything? I don't know that it changes everything. You know, one of the good stories that I see all over the world, including in China and including the United States, with reference to coronavirus, when you think about, you know, the people in New York or in the UK, clapping. When you think about the people in Wuhan singing together out of their apartment windows, this is actually pretty beautiful, reaffirming stuff that should give us some confidence. What we haven't seen is a lot of coronavirus-related violence in different societies and bad behavior. It's true that in the United States there was a rush on buying more guns and more ammunition. But there was a rush on buying guns and ammunition when Obama was elected. There's a rush on buying guns and ammunition every time there's another mass shooting because people want to make sure they can buy weapons while it's still available. But in fact, what we've really seen in most countries is a wonderful sense of common cause. We have seen generosity. We've seen outreach. We haven't seen a lot of anger and violence. You just in our neighborhood here the other day, I don't know who did it, but somebody went around with chalk and in front of everybody's driveway, just drew a big heart and wrote "Be well" in the middle of that. You come out and you see that, and it's uplifting and it's hopeful. And there are stories like this, again, in China, I'm sure they are in Hong Kong. I find this very encouraging. We have seen, yes, people are fearful, but they're full of humor and generosity and charity and creativity and innovation at the same time. So, yes, be driven by the science, combat the pandemic, but chest out, chin up. Actually, there's been a lot of stuff that should be inspiring for us that's coming out of the pandemic as well. And I take actually a lot of hope in that. I think it's been underreported.
There are certainly lessons that Western countries should learn from China's response to COVID-19. For example, the use of drones to disinfect area and to tell citizens to practice social distancing. but we also have to be mindful about the use of data, data privacy concerns when China uses data to monitor people's movement.
You see, I'm not sure that we do want to learn all those lessons. I don't think that Americans want a drone watching what we're doing and telling us to social distance. A lot of Americans are inclined to whip out a shotgun and blow the drone out of the sky. Here you really do run into, obviously we should be practicing social distancing, and most Americans are. Most of them are. But I don't want drones, government drones, watching our behavior, knowing where we are, yelling at us. You know, I think of the LABA, the big, you know, the ubiquitous megaphone speakers during the Cultural Revolution, yelling Maoist slogans at us. Here you really do run into a question, I think, of culture and values. And I think that a lot of Americans are practicing social distancing, and it appears that we are flattening the curve. Big mistakes have been made up front, mostly of our own fault, because, you know, the White House said that this was a hoax and denied that it mattered, that there have been really, people are culpable for some of these errors. But no, we don't want a surveillance state. I think that a lot of Americans would probably say they're willing to have a slightly higher chance of transmitting the coronavirus in order to not have a government drone looking over their shoulder. I'm not sure, I don't think that is something we want to learn from the CCP.
The 2008 financial crisis saw China's rapid rise in the global stage as well as U.S. relative decline. 12 years later, history repeats itself again as the U.S. struggles to contain the spread of the virus, at least for now. The world's number one power seems reluctant to lead a global effort to combat the crisis. For example, President Trump bans 3M recently from exporting protective gears even to allies, countries like Canada. Would this be a major tipping point for China to become a global hegemon in the 21st century, or is it too soon to tell?
Again, too soon to tell. You're certainly right that America, America had abandoned ambitions to global leadership. That was beginning in 2017. And since that time, America has been leading soft power around the world for a number of reasons. And that has worsened, that has accelerated during the coronavirus for exactly the reasons that you mentioned. I think what the American president should be saying, especially to Canada and Mexico, but the rest of the world in a time like this, is that you are our brothers and sisters. And we want to work together and do all we can to manufacture and supply and educate and inform. This is the historic American role, and you're absolutely correct. America has abandoned that, and this is more of a story about America's abandoning the field than it is a story about China's taking the field. Again, other nations like Chinese resources, depending on the conditions with which they're offered, but there's no embrace of Chinese Communist Party values, there's no welcoming in of more political, social, cultural influence from the CCP. There's no embrace of Chinese contemporary culture. There's no real admiration for the CCP vision of what it means to be human, what human beings' relationships with their government should be. So it's not clear that merely having the wealth, the industrial capacity, and the willingness to sell these goods translates simply into more real power or hegemonic influence for a Chinese Communist Party for which the Enlightenment still hasn't occurred. Because the Enlightenment has occurred in the rest of the world. People want to partake in modernity. This is what the Hong Kong protests are about. They're a flat-out rejection of the governance, social, and political models of the CCP. This is what Tsai Ing-wen's re-election is about. We know, just as we know, that before the coronavirus, America had been bleeding soft power and losing influence in all the ways that you described. We also know that before the coronavirus, the Communist Party's model of governance had been firmly rejected at great risk, even on China's periphery and even in places like Hong Kong that are part of the People's Republic of China. The coronavirus does not change that. So the notion that this virus, that this horrible period, has suddenly coalesced all of these long-term trends and has flipped the script on global hegemony and has opened the doors for global acceptance of Chinese Communist Party style authoritarianism or techno-totalitarianism. There's no evidence of that. There's no reason yet to say that this is true. And again, part of this is the tyranny of the now, fear, and the 24/7 news cycle, which has us overanalyzing and predicting everything and whipping up a froth in which everybody is fearful and anxious and glued to their television and computer screens. I think more about that blue chalk heart in front of my driveway that says we will. I think more about the people of Wuhan singing to each other when they're locked in their apartments. What a gorgeous thing. People applauding for healthcare workers. I don't see calling out for lead us, Xi Jinping, show us the way. We see a lot of rejection.
I think from a people-to-people level, it would be easier for Chinese and Americans to come together than versus on a government level.
Yes. There's no question about that. And even people to people, I think, it's getting a little bit tougher. I see this, I'm in dialogue with a lot of Chinese America watchers who are old friends and for whom I have tremendous liking and very high professional regard. And it's getting harder and harder for us to find common language or a common understanding of where we are in the relationship. So I think the U.S.-China relations, and I said this even before the coronavirus, this gets worse, not better. We haven't seen bottom yet. The coronavirus is driving us toward the bottom more quickly, that's true, but it's probably a bottom that we were headed toward anyway. And this is going to remain true for a long time, and this is going to be particularly difficult for the people of Hong Kong. And it's going to be tough for Americans doing business in Hong Kong, for the members of the American chamber. This gets more difficult, and there's going to be continued high levels of uncertainty. And you're going to have to do continued political risk analysis in a way that wasn't as necessary, even for 2 decades or so after the handover.
On American home front, while President Trump had stopped using the term Chinese virus to describe COVID-19, there are already serious repercussions, not only in terms of U.S.-China relations, but also in American society, causing backlash against the Asian American community. A point that is worth noting is that many of the healthcare workers in the U.S. are actually Asian Americans. How should President Trump address this issue? And what are the implications of American soft power?
So, again, good questions. There's no question but that this calling this the Chinese virus, emphasis on, because Chinese, unlike saying Wuhan virus, they don't call it the Wuhan virus either, but Wuhan is a city. Chinese refers to both a country but also a nationality. And I think that that did spur anti-Chinese and then anti-Asian racism in the United States. And there are specific incidences that we can point to in which that was clearly the case. And this is ongoing. People on the hard right call it the commie cold, which is a little more political and less about nations or persons. President Trump has stopped using that phrase. And after initially saying that it wasn't racist, I think that it's been brought to bear on him that no, in fact, it is. And it has been the cause of violence. And as you say, a tremendous number of people in the health professions are Asian Americans.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is going to, this is just my sense from reading news headlines. There's always going to be some of that. In a place that's as racially diverse and has the sorts of freedom of speech that the United States has. But we've probably seen the peak of that, and I think that we're backing off of that a little bit. There's a little bit less of that going forward. At the same time, because U.S.-China rivalry, I think, will be deepening, I think that there are going to be always some residual difficulties for Chinese Americans who have always and continue to make absolutely essential contributions to this country as Americans, not only in medicine, but in all of the sciences and in journalism and in the arts and in you name it, this is going to be very difficult. And it's incumbent upon all American leaders and the media to take great care not to present this rivalry, not to describe this rivalry, which in any way puts more pressure on Chinese American populations, because those very people are actually one of our greatest guarantors of peace and of reason and of understanding in this relationship, because they, above more than anyone else, have the ability to translate between the two cultures, the two countries, and to tamp down some of the more extreme forms of animus. They're absolutely essential. They're one of, you know, the presence and the activity and the expertise of the Chinese Americans is actually one of the factors that's at the top of the positive ledger as we look at U.S.-China rivalry. This is one of the populations that can be most helpful. And so we have to be assiduous in not attacking them. And I'm afraid, as you said, we haven't done very well with that. I think we're doing a little bit better now. But it's probably going to, you know, come and go. There will be peaks and troughs because of human nature.
One last question. The U.S. presidential election is on the sideline right now as Americans across the country are battling the coronavirus. But the election will be held in about 200 days, which means it is still early stage to predict if President Trump could win the election. It will certainly be a referendum on how he handles the coronavirus situation. But would U.S.-China relations change much regardless of who is in the White House?
I think that the broad course of U.S.-China relations, the fact that this relationship is now fundamentally competitive, contentious, rather than about cooperation, that won't change. That is a historical, in the main, that's a historical structural phenomenon. Donald Trump didn't start it. Xi Jinping didn't start it. They have both made it worse. There's no question about it. There's plenty of responsibility to go around. But in the main, I think it's a structural issue. I think that if we had a Biden presidency, there would be more predictability, a little bit less uncertainty in the relationship. There would certainly be less uncertainty, less volatility, but the nature of the relationship wouldn't change. This is something that no one national leader can change altogether. I think that the single most helpful policy change that could occur to really reduce tension, the single biggest question, is whether or not China is interested in truly re-embracing reform and opening. Not that that's a panacea, not that that would do away with competition altogether, it certainly would not. But I think it's the single most important factor in the relationship was under Xi Jinping, the rejection of opening and reform combined with increased repression in Maoist modes at home and increased assertiveness overseas. That is what I think, that's the single biggest change factor that brought us to where we are today. And that's the biggest change that one would look for more stability in the relationship. Not that that's something that's easy or that changes everything overnight, but really that and not who's in the White House, I think, is the biggest factor.
Inside a beltway, there is a consensus to go tough on China. The structure of the U.S.-China relationship has fundamentally changed, but if you look at state level or university level, when you were a director at the Maryland China Initiative, which provides training programs to Chinese government officials, that doesn't seem to change, although it might change in the future. But there are some sort of connections, cultural linkages between the two countries as the U.S. receives a lot of Chinese students in the country. So there's some form of cooperation, and it's hard to decouple the two countries. Probably there's some partial decoupling, but you can't really decouple entirely.
No, that's right, nor should you. But you can decouple more than we've decoupled already. The costs of that are high. Some of the implications of that are dire, but we do see American attitudes as understood by the CCP, not toward the Chinese people. There have been a number of Mini Diaocha public opinion surveys showing that American views of China are actually declining quite rapidly. There is a lot of anger in the United States over the coronavirus toward China. You can think that that's legitimate or not, but the anger is real either way. And there is pressure for more decoupling. There's certainly more suspicion at the state, local, community, and institutional level. All of this is ongoing. I don't say this happily. I thought that at the time, policy of engagement was both constructive and essential. But I don't think we can go back to that, because there have been, again, changes in China, away from reform and opening, toward repression domestically and assertiveness internationally, which involves the legitimization of illiberal practices. I think that those are indisputable facts, that has changed. And that does have an implication. It has implications for certain kinds of exchange activities. And again, I don't think we've seen bottom. I'm not celebrating this, I'm not advocating for all of it. It's simply what I see and where I think the relationship is headed.
Well, on that note, this is the worst of times, but it should also be the best of times for countries, especially for US and China, to cooperate on global issues like infectious diseases, climate change, and terrorism. So we just hope for the best for the future. Thank you very much,
and
Robert.
Work for the best. Not just hope, but work.
Yes, work toward that goal. Thank you very much, Robert.
Thank you.